is the Communication Research Podcast, a production of the Communication Research Center at Boston University. In this podcast, we have a colloquium presentation by Professor Deb Jaramillo entitled Dead Mexican, The Traumatized Suburbanite and the Violent Narcotraficante in Breaking Bad and Weeds. After the podcast, stay tuned for information about how you can find out about the Communication Research Center and its programs. Thank you.
Hi, thank you so much for coming. I am going to commit a faux pas of sorts. I'm not going to start with my argument. I'm actually going to take you through my thought process, all right, but we will get there. I want to explain to you at the outset that I watch what a lot of people would consider to be a lot of television, right? I try to watch between 20 to 30 hours per week. Sometimes I don't hit that mark. I'm a little bit of a slacker right now, especially the beginning of the semester, but a girl's got to sleep, right? So you can't always kind of hit that mark. And experts, right, will tell you that watching that much television is bad. What do they know? There are so many benefits that come from engaging with a lot of television. One major positive that I want to present to you at the outset is that if you watch a nice quantity of television at any given moment, you begin to detect patterns, right? Patterns start to emerge, and conversations actually start to emerge. Conversations between television programs. And I don't mean literal conversations, I don't mean intentional conversations. Nevertheless, there is a discourse that starts to come out. So my example is this kind of recent spate of television programs that are set on or near the U.S.-Mexico border, all right? So Breaking Bad and Weeds, obviously. If you're not familiar with Breaking Bad, you need to fix that problem immediately, right? Breaking Bad is set in New Mexico. Weeds is set in California. And even though I'm not going to be talking about it too much, a show like Big Love, which is about the Mormon community, set in Utah. And last year, they actually had an interesting storyline that took place in Mexico that recalled some events that happened recently in Mexico, some kind of tragic and violent interactions between the established Mormon community in the northern Mexican state of Chihuahua, and Los Zetas, which are the paramilitary group that have played a very destructive role in the drug war in Mexico right now. So we have then these programs that are set on and near the border, and you can't set programs there without actually dealing with the politics, with the culture. All right. So this is the kind of thing that I'm talking about, and I might be extra sensitive to these conversations because I was born and raised in a town 15 minutes from the border with Mexico in Texas. In Texas, we measure distance in units of time. So really, really close to the border. And so I'm really, really interested in how the border tends to be represented in film and television, all right? The border is a much, much more complicated place than a lot of people give credit for. So it's interesting to me that these programs that are set there are actually incorporating events from the drug war in Mexico, but they're also incorporating Mexican drug culture, all right, in really, really compelling ways. So my purpose is not actually to talk about the representation of Mexico on television. That's a paper I don't want to write. It's a paper that other people have written. My purpose actually is to trace what I consider to be an interesting development in cable series, all right? A development that hinges on the character of the Mexican drug dealer, the narcotraficante, and we'll call him the narco for short, all right? But it hinges on that character, but the development is actually most evident in the treatment of the character of the suburbanite. So basically, we're dealing at one level with treatment of characters that are related to shifts in narrative paradigms, all right, on cable television. And these, in turn, are related to industrial circumstances, all right, what's going on cable. Okay. So where does this title come from? I want to show you a clip first from Weeds. This is from, not the season that's airing right now, the previous season. And in this clip, you'll see Celia, who is the protagonist's frenemy. Celia's living in Nancy's garage, and then she makes a discovery.
Dead Mexican!
So the next clip I want to show you is actually from Big Love. All right. In this clip, the family of the main character is, the volume is as high as it goes. In this clip, the family of the main character is in Mexico. They're trying to smuggle birds, all right? And the guy that they're using, the Mexican guy they're using to smuggle birds, is also a smuggler for this guy, like the main kind of Mormons who have established themselves there.
But why were you at the stall of the Starwitz?
You and I never have an exclusive contract.
Speak when you're spoken to. Answer the question.
Oye, pinche viejo, tengo mi propio nombre, oíste?
No, I come up to your country and you treat me like cheap. That's okay. It's your country. But then you come down here and you still treat me like cheap. You are in contempt.
Contempt for what? For what? Shut up.
And you, madam, will answer the question put before you.
Well, what was the question?
So we have two dead Mexicans, right? This is what I mean by a conversation that starts to emerge between these television programs. In Big Love, we have the very valid point made by Manuel, for those of you who didn't hear it. He said, look, I go to your country and you treat me like shit, and that's fine, it's your country. You come to my country and you still treat me like shit? No, that's not how we're gonna do things. And then, of course, he's dead. This, in my reading, is actually quite relevant within the text, and it's relevant extra-textually, outside of the text as well. So by textual, I mean, okay, what U.S. television has done to the body of the Mexican in predominantly white shows is one thing, right? When U.S. television starts to incorporate more and more of Mexico into its programs, then things need to change, all right? So in Weeds, we have our first dead Mexican, this time a narco, and his name in the show is Sucio, which literally means dirty. So we have a dirty dead Mexican in Weeds, all right? And it's very much played for laughs, isn't it? Both dead bodies actually carry meaning not on their own, but because they embody the threat of violence, all right? They represent what might happen to Anglos in the story. It just so happens in Big Love that before Manuel was killed, he was able to make a point that not many Mexicans on U.S. television have been able to make, all right? Even if he was killed making that point. The point is very telling, how U.S. television has dealt with the figure of the Mexican, all right? So this is what we mean by a textual and extra-textual importance. Now, historically on U.S. television, which I think we can all agree has been white-dominated narratives, organized illegal activity has opened up spaces for the foreigners, right? If we think about cop dramas and the various places where cop dramas have been set, we can think of, well, who are typically the criminals here? In New York, the Puerto Ricans and the Dominicans. And if you watched NYPD Blue, for instance, when it ran on ABC, they referred to the Puerto Rican criminals just as PRs, right? Everybody got to know that, the PRs, those are the Puerto Ricans. In Florida, Central Americans and Cubans. In L.A., Mexicans, some Salvadorans, all right? But for the majority of the cop programs that are set in L.A., the Mexican criminal is the one that has the kind of strongest presence. Now, the cop dramas, or the cop formula, has moved very seamlessly from broadcast television to cable, all right? So we have a show like The Shield, which was on FX, and we have shows like Southland, which literally moved from broadcast to cable. It started off on NBC, and now it's on TNT. And Mexican criminals have followed, or perhaps they've been kind of dragged along to cable, all right? But cable has allowed for the development of a new type of program that finally breaks away from the cops, docs, and lawyers formula that has flourished and floundered on broadcast. So we have a show like The Sopranos, and everybody always talks about The Sopranos, but it really does represent a key moment in cable television when criminals, where criminals can be the much-loved protagonists, all right, of a narrative. There's a reason why this is a new paradigm, all right? In 1951, the television industry in the U.S. adopted what they called the television code, all right? This was essentially to stave off really aggressive intervention by the FCC to regulate content, all right? This is what it says about criminality. Criminality shall be presented as undesirable and unsympathetic. The condoning of crime and the treatment of the commission of a crime in a frivolous, cynical, or callous manner is unacceptable. All right, this is the antithesis of The Sopranos, right? And even though the television code disintegrated over the years, quite obviously, the sentiments and the kind of sensitivities behind these kinds of rules remain. All right. This is why it's on broadcast. It's always about the cops. It's always about the lawyers. It's about law and order, right? The criminals are the folks who need to get caught. The criminals aren't the folks that are at the center, right? So in Breaking Bad and Weeds, both focus on suburbanites who have entered the drug trade. And both of these shows, and just in case you don't know, Breaking Bad is on AMC and Weeds is on Showtime. Both of these shows extend the paradigm of The Sopranos with new implications for the Mexican criminal element, all right? So what makes them unique? The threat and the distribution of violence on the US-Mexico border greatly inform the narrative trajectories of both of these shows, all right? So if we think about our protagonists here, Breaking Bad and Weeds, they both suffered some kind of trauma, right? In Breaking Bad, Walt has been diagnosed with cancer, so he feels he needs to cook crystal meth to make some money, actually, to leave for his family. In Weeds, Nancy has lost her husband, and she has kind of no marketable skills. So she starts dealing marijuana. The trauma basically forces them to initiate narratives that generally have no room for white middle-class moms and dads. All right, the narratives that these characters initiate typically have been tangential on television. They're the narratives of the criminals who get caught, right? And these narratives have typically been occupied by the foreigner, in our case, Mexican drug dealers, the narcos, right? The narcos, then, as characters, have had to accommodate these white characters basically entering into their occupation, right? So what we have here is the televisual reversal of decades of xenophobic rhetoric. Essentially, white characters are stealing Mexican characters' jobs, all right? It's really kind of interesting how this is happening, and it's kind of funny, but there actually is a slippage that's occurring here, all right? There's a slippage between the very put-upon Mexican characters and the larger tradition of how Mexican characters have been positioned on television, all right? So we can again look to the cop drama. And obviously, as the cop genre matured, things got a little muddy, but they typically tend to have a clear good and evil binary, all right? Even if the cop is playing by his own rules, we still know the position of the narco. Okay, the narco is the bad guy who needs to be stopped. In cable programs, cop genres or not, they tend to be a little less Manichaean, all right? Anglo good guys are able to transgress with very minimal detection, and Mexican characters are actually not silenced on cable. They're actually pushed into a bit into a more complicated role. They used to be one-dimensional hoods, all right, but now they speak and they think and they act with an agency that's articulated in both English and Spanish, all right. So I told you we'd get here. Here's the argument: as cable series have altered these kind of long-standing narrative paradigms that are tied to genre, they've made room for a more complex vision of violence that actually recalls the paradigms of the Mexican narcocorridos, all right? So there's a whole other layer to this. And basically, this complexity is engendered by the events of the drug war that's going on right now in Mexico and how these are being incorporated into the series. As programs that rely on the realities of the drug trade, Weeds and Breaking Bad incorporate, or they try to incorporate, a more nuanced and culturally informed characterization of the Mexican drug culture, all right? One that significantly impacts the relationship of the suburbanite to their new trade, all right? So let's move into the corrido, all right? How many of y'all have heard of corridos before? Exactly, okay. We are in Boston. Corridos are folk songs, all right? And in the US, scholarship on corridos have come from scholars like Américo Paredes, whose book, With His Pistol in His Hand, is like the seminal text basically dealing with the cultural and social importance of corridos. So they're songs that are rooted in Spanish romances, these epic poems that go back to the 13th century. And the corridos and the romances actually share the same meter. All right, so these are very, very old school types of songs. They're not just folk songs, however. They straddle a very interesting line between narrative and news. Okay? The subjects of corridos have tended to be Mexican folk heroes, and the earliest corridos came out of struggles between Mexicans and Anglos. So, you know, between Mexican men defending their rights and the rights of their communities from the injustices perpetrated by, you know, groups like armed posses or legitimate state entities like the Texas Rangers, all right? Very, very violent clashes wound up being, put to songs, basically. So early corridos basically chronicled individual encounters that came as a result of the very, very tense relations between Anglos and Mexicans in the 19th century and the early 20th century. Just for some context, remember that the U.S. and Mexico have gone to war twice. And including those wars and on other occasions, the U.S. has actually invaded Mexico 5 times. So there's some tension, right? And I think we probably noticed this tension. So corridos dealt with epic themes, issues of justice and oppression. But we have these like large systemic issues that are essentially personalized in the form of the corrido, right? It's the little guy going up against the big bad guy. Now, these corridos can be about events that happened 100 years ago or 5 minutes ago. So I include this for you. This is an album cover. It's Corridos of the Mexican Revolution. All right. So there are many, many corridos written about the revolution, about Pancho Villa, etc. Right. But corridos can be about very, very contemporary content as well. Maria Herrera Sobek is one scholar who's written extensively about corridos, and she reminds us of this time in 1987 when the bodies of 18 undocumented workers were found dead in a railroad boxcar in Texas, right? So immediately after that discovery, a corrido was written about it. It was called El Vagón de la Muerte, the Boxcar of Death. And then a film followed, actually, with the same title, and then 2 other similar films came after. So Herrera Sobek writes that corridos in cinema have actually had a very, very close relationship for a long time. Many Mexican films have been based on corridos. And the narrative structure of corridos, they are linear. They do a cause-effect chain. Sometimes they're told in flashback. And the heroic or the tragic subject matter of the corridos actually make them ripe for cinematic adaptation, and I would argue just long-form narrative adaptation. So television is obviously part of this as well. The most famous corridos that have been adapted into cinema have actually been narco corridos. All right. So this is another album cover. So narco inserts the drug angle into corridos. Right, and just from the album cover, just from the iconography, you can get a sense of what's going on here. We have at the top an accordion, all right, referencing the type of music, the Mexican polka, which actually comes from German music. Of course, we have our marijuana leaves at the bottom, and our automatic weapons in the middle. And it says down here, a trip through the world of music, of drugs, guns, and guerrillas. All right, so narco corridos use the same formula as traditional corridos, but they chronicle the exploits of the narcos, all right, of drug dealers. This is a kind of contemporary, this is cover art for a contemporary narco corrido album. And you'll see that the musicians actually that sing these like to insert themselves, in the cover art at least, into this kind of lifestyle of the narco. So here's the singer, and he's not a narco. But you see him back there with his, with his automatic weapon. You have the bullet holes, etc. So they kind of insert themselves into that fantasy, even though they're chronicling narcos. They're not actually narcos themselves, most of them at least. The first true narco corrido was called Contrabando y Traición. This is from 1972. It's translated as smuggling and betrayal. So here's the story. It's a really interesting story. There are 2 marijuana smugglers. All right, Emilio and Camelia La Tejana, Camelia the Texan, right? So a man and a woman, and they're smuggling pot from Tijuana to LA. They get across the border just fine, they make their contact, they unload the drugs, and then Emilio turns to Camelia and says, we did fabulously with the money that you made here. You can go back to Mexico and remake your life. I, however, am splitting for San Francisco to hook up with my true love, all right? The owner of my life, it says in the song. Camelia is not happy with this, so she picks up the gun and she kills him. She leaves the gun, she takes the money, not the cannoli, and she flees. And this is how the song ends, all right? I want to play for you. The song was actually recorded by Los Tigres del Norte in 1972, and it was a really, really big hit for them. I want to play you the end, and obviously, I mean, if you don't speak Spanish, don't worry about it. I want you to just kind of hear what goes on in the song, because there's a really kind of significant moment. Hopefully, the audio will be okay. No one ever heard from Camelia ever again, all right? But what I wanted you to pay attention to were the gunshots, all right? So there's a tendency in these corridos, in these narco corridos, to act out the violence, and this is a very, very common element of the narco corridos now. Typically, in some of these songs, you'll hear the violence play out actually at the beginning, all right? And we tend to associate this with like gangster rap, where there's a lot of police sirens and whatnot, but it's a very, very common element in the narco corrido. Now, the character of Camelia was so intriguing to people that she actually spawned several other corridos simply about her, because it was an open-ended narrative. Nobody knew what happened to her. So other composers wrote songs, and then, of course, there was the film, all right? So once again, we have this instance of a corrido being a basis for a hit film. Now, the important point here is that Emilio and Camelia were fictional characters, all right? Later characters in narco corridos actually were not. So what began as a subgenre that was inherently cinematic, because it was fictitious, right, and it was kind of had an action film type thing going for it, actually became a subgenre that resembled journalism more than anything else, because the characters became real, right? Even more disturbing, and one of the reasons why a lot of Mexican radio stations actually refused to play narco corridos, is because actual narcos actually commission corridos to be written about them, all right, so to chronicle their exploits and whatnot. So the result, then, is a narrative form of music that's steeped in the tradition of heroism, but now centering on criminals who believe they are the heroes, right? So narco corridos have their home base in Sinaloa, which is a state in the west coast of Mexico. So it's on the coast, so it's always been a locale for smugglers. In the early part of the 20th century, the U.S. actually had opium cultivated there so they could make morphine for troops during World War II. But once the U.S. didn't need that opium anymore, it remained a center of cultivation. So Sinaloa plays a very, very big role in everything we're going to talk about. excuse me. I want to play for you now, actually, an actual narco corrido video, all right? And the band is called Los Cuates de Sinaloa. Cuates are twins, right? They're twins. And so the name of the song is El Carril Número Tres, and I apologize if this isn't translated. It doesn't matter. I want you to pay attention to the images, all right, the story that's told here. But this is basically what the song is about. It's about a narco who has amassed such power and such wealth that he's actually able to bribe CIA agents, all right? So when crossing the border, he gets into lane number 3, and they know him there, so he's able to cross to the other side to do his business in the U.S. So kind of pay attention to the aesthetics of the video and pay attention to the narrative that's interspersed throughout. Always naked women. Always.
secreto de la CIA, involucrada la DEA, en los Estados Unidos, aunque muchos no lo crean, también existen corruptos, donde los grandes batean. Hay datos en los archivos de un hombre que es muy buscado, tiene precio su cabeza, en internet publicaron, mas no le quitan el sueldo, porque está bien arreglado. El carril número 3 de una frontera en el norte, para él está designado, pues pagó muchos millones, triplicó la recompensa y puso sus condiciones. En una troca del año, el señor pasa tranquilo, en las placas trae la clave, contraseña para los gringos. Él mira al ver la señal, le deja libre el camino. Otra vez se ha demostrado que el poder queda el dinero. Ya ven cómo un mexicano pudo comprar a los güeros, y aunque es de los más buscados, se les mete a su terreno. Este permiso especial la CIA lo ha negociado, y el carril número 3 siempre será el designado, pa' que pase un gran señor que compras al otro lado.
So this gives you a sense of what a narco-corrido video, how a video is kind of constructed and presented. So these narco-corridos have spawned films in the past, and now they're finding themselves connected to U.S. television. In the last season of Breaking Bad, a video by Los Guates de Sinaloa opened up an episode for Breaking Bad. All right, so this was the very beginning of the episode, and this actually is translated. But if you can't see the subtitles, essentially they're singing about the main character, Walt, who is operating as a drug dealer under the pseudonym Heisenberg. The story tells of how he's pissed off basically the Mexican drug cartels and how his life is gonna end soon.
La ciudad se llama Tú. Nuevo México, el estado. Entre la gente mafiosa, su fama se ha propagado, causa de una nueva droga que los gringos han creado. Dicen que es color azul y que es pura calidad. La droga poderosa que circula en la ciudad, y los dueños de la plaza no la pudieron parar. Anda caliente el cartel, al respeto le faltaron. Hablan de un tal Heisenberg que ahora controla el mercado. Nadie sabe nada de él, porque nunca lo han mirado en carteles de respeto y jamás ha perdonado. Ese compa ya está muerto, no más no le han avisado.
Y así suenan los cuates de Sinaloa, mi compa.
Oh.
príncipe ya llegó hasta Michoacán. Le tenía que venir a tomar ese cristal, ese material azul ya se hizo internacional. Ahora sí le quedó bien a Nuevo México el nombre. A México se parece en tanta droga que esconde, solo que hay un capo gringo, por Heisenberg lo conoce. Anda caliente el cartel, al respeto le faltaron. Hablan de un tal Heisenberg que ahora controla el mercado. Nadie sabe nada de él, porque nunca lo han mirado. A la furia del cartel, nadie jamás ha escapado. Ese compa ya está muerto, nomás no le han avisado.
So the episode was called Negro y Azul, Black and Blue, and that's the name of the song as well. And Vince Gilligan, the creator of Breaking Bad, co-wrote the song and had Los Cuates record it. So throughout season three, Breaking Bad dug deeper and deeper into the politics and the culture of the Mexican drug cartels. And with the inclusion of this Narco Corrido within the text of the show, the series basically inserts Walt's character into the role that Mexican narcos usually play, but with the warning that he's most definitely on his way out. And because this video appears at the beginning of an episode, it performs a few functions that I want to talk about. First, it frames the episode in a manner similar to what Herrera Sobeck writes about in her study of Mexican films based on corridos. The corrido structures what is to come in the narrative, and while many corridos actually begin by recounting the death of the hero, Negro y Azul, the song, announces Walt's impending death in its chorus. More important than the framing function, actually, is the video's intertextual function. For those who are familiar with Narco Corridos, not just the content, but the style of the videos, where they come from, and who actually makes them, this is an important tribute to that tradition. If you know absolutely nothing about Narco Corridos, this might have completely, and if you're watching Breaking Bad, you don't know anything about Narco Corridos, it might have alienated you in a kind of an interesting way, because they don't explain it, all right? And it's never kind of recouped within the narrative. It's just this great moment that is an in-joke, in a way. Finally, and most importantly, is the way in which this video actually merges the narrative of Breaking Bad with the narrative structure of the corrido, right? If the band had omniscience, the song would have been much longer. There would have been several more stanzas kind of chronicling the twists and turns that the show has actually taken. But in keeping with the tradition of the Narco Corrido, it focuses on the drugs. And in keeping in the tradition, Walt, our main character, is elevated to the status of hero, right? And even though he operates under a pseudonym, Heisenberg, he remains shrouded in mystery, but he's inserted into Mexican drug culture. He's now a legend, right, because of this corrido. And the series basically has figured out how to merge the character of the narco with the character of the suburbanite. If we move over to Weeds, Nancy is a figure in need of a narco corrido. All right, she's almost the kind of 20th century version, 20th century white version of Camelia La Tejana from the original narco corrido. Like Walt, her occupation has meant that she's wandered into what traditionally has been Mexican territory on U.S. television. But unlike Walt from Breaking Bad, she actually does wander into Mexico. In Breaking Bad, Mexico kind of comes to Walt. And instead of the more creative strategies of bringing the suburbanite and narco together, like in Breaking Bad, Weeds relies less on drug culture and more on drug-related events that have been happening in Mexico, excuse me, to give more agency to Mexican characters. There's a scholar by the name of Pablo Vila who wrote this book called Reinforcing Borders, and in that book he talks about the main kind of hegemonic narratives that we adopt and that shape people's understandings of Mexico, Mexicans, and Mexican Americans. And a few of these narratives, such as that all Mexicans are dirty and lazy, that all poverty in the Southwest U.S. is Mexican, and that any wealth displayed by Mexicans comes as a result of drug money. These narratives actually play a very large role in the way that Weeds interacts with the border. I remind you of Sucio, our original dead Mexican, who is the dirty dead Mexican. Interestingly, the Mexican man, the mayor of Tijuana, Esteban, with whom Nancy has a relationship and shares a baby, he is a corrupt politician in the show. He is violent. He gets his money from drug and human smuggling. What's actually really fascinating about this character is that he's more than a collection of these hegemonic narratives. He actually is based on the actual former mayor of Tijuana, Jorge Jaime Ron, who was involved in all kinds of smuggling, and he comes from a very corrupt family, etc. So while Breaking Bad mines contemporary Mexican drug culture for semiotic authenticity, what Weeds does is mine Mexican news for narrative authenticity. Right? So we have a very different connection to the narcocorrido than here. Both Weeds and narcocorridos are rooting their narratives in real events, right? Even if the end product is a little exaggerated. And if we consider also the merging of the characters of the narco and the suburbanite, we can remember that Weeds engages in some interesting, if very problematic, cultural exchanges. And we're not talking about Mexican culture, we're talking about the culture of violence and drugs, and this culture is communicated by Mexican characters. So I want to show you a series of clips from one episode of Weeds in which Ignacio, who is the man Esteban hires to have he's kind of the bodyguard, but he's also making sure that Nancy doesn't do anything stupid. So he kind of lives with the family, watches over the family. We're going to see how he teaches Shane, Nancy's teen son, how to be violent.
Good kid. Now he's robbing his teacher.
I am so sorry that I exposed him to the world of criminal activities for the first time.
So obviously, and Ignacio's point is well taken, that Nancy has made Shane kind of susceptible to all of this, but that Ignacio actually teaches Shane how to tap into his inner violent narco actually speaks volumes about the larger argument here that Mexican criminals are, they have to make narrative room for the new white criminals, all right? And whereas Breaking Bad's merger of the suburbanite and the narco happens in the figure of Walt, Weeds plants that merger firmly within the realm of domesticity, all right? The new violent Shane that's actually being used, it was used to promote the new season of Weeds, and you see up here, he has blood spattered on the side of his head because he did something really bad at the end of the previous season, which I won't spill for you. In any case, so that merger of the narco and the suburbanite is planted here and in the baby that Nancy and Esteban share. Just to wrap things up, you know, much of the discourse lately about the quality of television revolves around how revolutionary HBO and AMC and Showtime and FX have been. And it's accepted that on cable, our white protagonists are going to leave the comfort of their typical narratives. But what of the larger presence of Mexican narcos and Mexican drug culture? There are certainly new spaces for complexity and exchanges, but with some old assumptions still intact. So I'm happy to take any questions you might have. Yeah?
So the narco burritos, it's really interesting to think of that and then in terms of, like, in comparison to, like, gangster rap.
Right.
Where, like, it almost seems incongruous that you have these songs that are about, like, the same content that gangster rap's about, but gangster rap sort of feels violent, whereas the narco burritos feel like, I have no idea how to speak Spanish, so I could, like, be dancing to that, mm-hmm. but, like, knowing what it's about, it's like, you don't dance to that. And so, like, would you say that, like, there's definitely the whole discussion about the negative cultural impact of, like, gangster rap in the U.S., like, is there a similar thing in Mexico?
There are kind of two ways to answer this. First, in terms of the popular sentiment about narco corridos, and you can help me out here. You know, I've been in Mexico my husband's from Mexico. I've been in Mexico, you know, listening to a radio station that has said, you know, we do not play these things, et cetera, et cetera. So there's kind of outpouring of sentiment like that. And there's also a class issue, actually. If you noticed in the videos, Los Cuates de Sinaloa, they're coding themselves in a very rural way. this idea of being rural in Mexico is connected very deeply with being of a lower class, all right? So I've also read, comments by people of an upper class in Mexico saying, that's for poor uneducated people. We don't listen to that, right? Educated people don't listen to that. So that's in terms of popular sentiment. In terms of academic scholarship, there's actually been work done on the kinds of effects that these songs might have on a culture, and some people would argue that they actually celebrate violence, but others argue that rather than celebrating violence, the narcocorridos actually help people heal and work through the violence in an interesting way. And then others argue they don't celebrate, they're not about healing, they're actually warning people that they have some kind of a moral to them, which you can easily argue against if, you know, the narcos are commissioning these things to be written about them, and they can be very celebratory, particularly if you bring in the album cover art to the conversation, where, I mean, it's all about kind of romanticizing the violence and whatnot. But you bring up an interesting point that it seems strange that such violent lyrics would be paired with music that seems just so kind of jaunty and you can dance to it and whatnot, because this is a very old form of music, right? And early corridos are, you know, they're very kind of benign musical form, and that you can dance to them, and, you know, they're easy to listen to. So to transplant the very violent subject matter onto this basically 13th century form of music it kind of blows your mind a little bit. It's a really good point. Yeah.
I have two questions that link themselves. First, like, how much of the big deal is it that those Mexican characters are being taken over by white characters in those shows? Like, because at the same time, it still feels like finally we get a presentation of what Mexico is like, or some idea of it, like presentation finally to corridos, which a lot of people don't know about. And then secondly, like, how real is it that it might spill over, and how much of the, like, in a realistic world, like right now, how much possibility is there that it can spill into
that what would spill over?
That some white people might become narcotraficantes and have such an influence.
Ah, okay. Well, I mean, white drug culture is something. Yeah, I mean, white drug culture exists,
yeah,
certainly. But to pick up, like, the,
yeah,
the signs and the iconography and things like that for Mexican culture. That's an interesting question. To your first question, I mean, how significant is it? I think it represents, it's like a step forward and a step back. A step forward in that, you know, these shows have created really, really interesting Mexican characters, actually. And that Spanish is just as easily spoken on these U.S. shows as English is really, I mean, that's something that you wouldn't have seen, even several years ago, all right? So, you know, as people who want some kind of representation on television, it's one of those instances where you got to take what you can get, right? So we're still being put up there as narcos, right? As dirty, as violent, all right? However, within that, okay, at least there's some kind of agency, at least there's some kind of intelligent characterization that's happening. And again, I mean, I think this has to do with these spaces that are opened up by cable. These spaces, you don't see them on broadcast because we're still conforming to the whole, you know, CSI paradigm and whatnot, exactly. So in terms of spillover, I mean, I don't know, because there's still, I mean, a lot of people in this country still hate Mexicans very vehemently. So I can't imagine that Mexican drug culture would have that much of an effect on white drug culture. I don't know.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions, comments? Okay, well, thank you so much for coming.
This was the Communication Research Podcast, a production of the Communication Research Center at Boston University. For more information about the Communication Research Center, please go to www.bu.edu/com/crc. Thank you.